Thank you very much. I thank both Ram and Kunal Nafti for the kind invitation. I would like to start my talk with the proof or a sketch of a proof of the first real transcendental result, which is due to Hermite, the fact that the number E is transcendental. So. I had the feeling that it would drop. Okay. I'm used to the ones that you put on your shirt. Okay. So, Hermite proved, I think it's around 1880, but Michel will probably tell me the right date. 73, okay. So he proved that E is transcendental. So by Kubar, I denote the field of real algebraic numbers. So the proof has three parts. So first is an analytic part. Because E is defined analytically, so you need some analytic tool. And the proof, the sketch of proof that I'm giving is not due to Hermite, it's something that applies to a more general situation, to transcendence in algebraic groups. So the first, the analytic part is the construction of a so-called auxiliary function. And the one that I will give is due to Michel Waldschmidt. And the following, you fix an epsilon between 0 and 1 over 6. And then what can be proved is that it's a special case of a construction of Michel Waldschmidt, is that for each sufficiently large integer n, there exists a non-zero polynomial p with integer coefficients in two variables, x and y, all denoted by p sub n because it depends on n, non-zero, of degree at most n, whose coefficients in absolute value are bounded above by exponential n to the 2 minus 3 epsilon. Okay. And with the property that the function f of z defined as p sub n z e to the z satisfies the kth derivative of f at n is bounded above by exponential minus n to the 2 minus 2 epsilon. So this denotes the kth derivative k running from 0 to the integer part of n to the 2 minus 3 epsilon, and m running from 0 to the integer part of n to the 1 minus 3 epsilon. Okay. So this is how this is constructed. It's constructing by asking that the derivative of f at 0 are small, but these are integers. So in fact, you ask that the derivatives of f at 0 are 0, and then you use the Schwarz lemma to deduce that many derivatives at many points are, the derivatives of f in a large ball are small. In particular, you get this. So this is the first part. Then there is a second part, which is Liouville inequality. And it's the following. You take an algebraic number alpha, and for any polynomial q with integer coefficients, if Q of alpha is not zero, then you can bound from below its absolute value. So assuming that Q of alpha is not zero, okay. We can bound from below the absolute value of Q of alpha by I took the log here. Okay, so log Q of alpha. Bounded below by a constant multiple of what I will write. So this, the constant depends on alpha. It's minus the degree of Q plus the log of the largest absolute value of its coefficients. So this is Liouville inequality. Okay. Now, how the two tools are combined? Well, you suppose you want to prove that E is transcendental, so suppose it's algebraic. Then you you look at these derivatives. So you take this. In fact, if you want, this also depends on n. Okay. And now you compute. You look at these numbers and you find that fk, the kth derivative at n, is the same thing as this differential operator applied k times to the polynomial p sub n evaluated at the point n e to the n. And this, you find, is a polynomial in E. This is it's a polynomial in E. Q is a polynomial with degree you see the degree doesn't increase by taking derivatives, so it's n times n, the largest value, and n can go up to n to the 1 minus 3 epsilon, so the degree is at most n to the 2 minus 3 epsilon. Okay. But by taking derivatives, the size of the coefficients will grow, and you can show that easily that the norm of Q, the maximum of the absolute value of the coefficients, if you take the log of that, that's bounded above by a constant times n to the 2 minus 3 epsilon log n. You get that. And finally, the logarithm of the absolute value of Q at E, that's just this, and this we saw was bounded above by this, we take the log, so we get minus n to the 2 minus 2 epsilon. And then you look at the Liouville inequality, and you see, because these numbers are much smaller than this one, there's an epsilon, this is bigger. So you multiply these two by n to the epsilon to get this. So the log, so by Liouville inequality, which is the second tool, it goes down alone. Eh? Okay. So by Liouville inequality, you deduce that the Q of E is zero, which means that all the derivatives of F at n are zero. Okay. And this is true for all k and m in the range that we had. And so 1 minus 3 epsilon. Okay. So the first thing was to construct an exponential polynomial that is small on a large ball, in particular its derivatives are small at the integers which lie in this ball, then you find that if E is algebraic, the derivatives are zero. And now you have something called the Tiedemann zero estimate, which shows that this is impossible. This can happen only if the degree, if the total number of unknown parameters in the polynomial P, you see P has degree at most n, so there are essentially n square unknown coefficients in P. And here you have the number of zeros is n to the, you mean the number of equations like that is n to the 3 minus 6 epsilon. And this is bigger than 2 if epsilon is less than 1 over 6. So the last step is, geometric because it deals with equality. This one is arithmetic. This is the only place where we use the fact that E is algebraic, and here we just use the conclusion here. So the geometric part in that case is Tiedemann zero estimate, which gives an estimate for the number of zeros of an exponential polynomial in a disk. And here the disk has reduced, so by Tiedemann, the degree of Pn square, which is roughly the number of parameters that you have in a polynomial of degree at most, of given degree, that should be bigger than a constant times the product of these two numbers here. But this is bounded above by n square times a constant. And this is impossible. So contradiction. Since epsilon is less than 1 over 6. This would imply that 2 is greater than or equal 3 minus 6 epsilon. So this is the typical argument in transcendence. You first use the fact that your objects are defined analytically to construct an analytic function that has a lot of small values, and then these small values happen to be zero because they lie in some field here, the field of complex of algebraic numbers, and then you conclude using algebraic geometry. Okay. So the construction of Michel Waldschmidt applies to algebraic groups in general, and here we have also zero estimates for on algebraic groups, which are very powerful. When you want to prove that two numbers are algebraically independent, you assume that they lie in a field generated by just one number, or in a field of transcendence degree one. So assume it's that field is generated by one number. So suppose you want to prove transcendence degree greater than or equal to 2. Essentially, the zero estimate says that the number of unknown coefficients that are in the construction of your auxiliary polynomial is roughly, should be greater than the number of conditions that you impose. But they are degeneracy. So you have to take into account possible degeneracies. And that's what the zero estimate says. Okay. It applies because the zeros here, you see, they lie in the subgroup generated by one in that case. Huh? So this is very important that the zeros have a certain structure and that. So if you want to prove transcendence degree two, then you don't use reveal inequality. You use instead, you replace two, the Liouville inequality by what is called Gelfand's lemma or Gelfand's criterion. And Gelfand's lemma reads as follows. You take a complex number psi, and you assume that, and you have two numbers, beta and mu, two parameters, beta and mu, linked by the following satisfying beta is positive and mu is greater than 1 plus beta. You suppose that for each capital, for each integer n, say greater than or equal to 1 or sufficiently large, there exists a non-zero polynomial q sub n with, say, integer coefficients. Of degree at most, okay, so not zero, of degree at most n log of the absolute log of the norm at most n to the beta, and the logarithm of the absolute value of Qn at psi is bounded above by minus n to the mu. Okay. Then the conclusion is that psi is algebraic. And moreover, this polynomial vanish for each n large enough. Okay. So this is Gelfand's lemma, and it's best possible because if you replace this inequality by mu smaller than 1 plus beta, then you can find such a polynomial for each n. This is the box principle that allows you to do that. So this is technical, but it's the best possible result. And when you apply it to certain situations, you can prove, like Michel Waldschmidt mentioned, that Gelfand proved that these two numbers are algebraically independent. Well, this is what is used. And when you want to use, when you want to prove the higher transcendence degree, you use Patrice Philippon's criterion of algebraic independence. Higher transcendence degree. There's something which is like that, except that you have some additional hypothesis that is needed. So there are several tools that one can use, but one of them is, I think the strongest is Philippon's criterion. For algebraic independence. And again, it's best possible. This criterion is best possible. But you see, it's best possible when you consider just one polynomial. And the question is it possible to extract more information from the data? You see, the idea is to use the criterion to deduce that the values you're working with are zero, in fact. And then you conclude. So with Michel Waldschmidt, we had some long time ago with this discussion, whether you can say something about values that are small. Because you see, he was explaining to me that if a function takes a small value, then all numbers that are close to the number where you evaluated will be, the value at these numbers will be small. And if a function is small at one point, it is small at the neighboring points. So the question is, can you say something of something which is small but not necessarily zero? Okay, so this is the question, and So the idea is to come. Well, okay. So as I said, this construction, which I gave here, there are more general constructions, and in particular, there are constructions depending on several parameters. So now, fix parameters S naught, S1, T naught, T1, and U positive, satisfying the following inequalities. The maximum of 1 T naught and 2 T1 is less than the minimum of S naught and 2 S1, and the maximum of S naught S1 plus T1 is bounded above by U, which is bounded above by 1 plus T naught plus T1 over 2. So very technical conditions, but there are numbers which satisfy this. I could give you some explicitly, like I did here, but it doesn't say more. And now for each of these data, you can make a conjecture. I propose the following conjecture. In fact, you can show that Chandler's conjecture is equivalent to a conjecture, one for each choice of parameters like that. So I will denote this conjecture by conjecture S naught, S1, S1, S naught, S1, T naught, T1, U. And the conjecture is essentially that the construction of Michel Waldschmidt captures all what we need to prove Chanuel's conjecture. Okay, so I will explain it in a minute. So you take complex numbers y1, yl. L is a positive integer, which are linearly independent over Q. And now you take an equal number of non-zero complex numbers, alpha 1, alpha L. You assume that for each N, each integer N, sufficiently large, there exists a non-zero polynomial Pn with integer coefficients in two variables x and y, whose degree in x is at most n to the t naught, whose degree in y is at most n to the t1, whose coefficients in absolute value are bounded above by exponential n, and with the property that well, the degree in x. So in x, every monomial has degree in x at most n to the t naught. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. No. That's a mistake. It's degree in y. Thank you very much. Now here the degrees are separated. It's because if you put t naught equal to t1, there's no solution to this inequality. Well, there's just one solution, but it's with equalities instead. So I have to take to separate the two degrees. Okay, and such that the maximum, so So you look at the absolute value of Pn at the points m1, y1 plus ml, yl, alpha 1 to the m1, alpha l to the ml. Here, the mi's run from 0 to n to the s1 and k. Okay, so this is... okay, so I have to put a differential operator here. Okay, this differential operator is the one that has been written before. I will write it down in a minute. K runs from 0 to n to the s0. Okay. This is bounded above by minus n to the u. So all parameters have been used. And suppose that, so the conjecture is given numbers y1, yl, alpha 1, alpha l, suppose that there exists a polynomial satisfying all those properties for each n. Then the transcendence degree over Q of the field generated by y1, yl, alpha 1, alpha l is at least l. Okay, so let me explain to you why this is equivalent to Chanel's conjecture. So suppose Chanel's conjecture says that if alpha 1 is exponential y1, alpha l is exponential yl, then then this field has transcendence degree at least L. Well, what happens is that if the conditions are satisfied, if these conditions are satisfied, I prove that each alpha I is the exponential of yi. So there is a theorem underlying all this, is that for L equals to 1, if the conditions are satisfied, alpha 1 is exponential y1 times the root of unity. Okay. So if you have data satisfying this, then this is the root of unity times e to the y1, this is the root of unity times e to the yl, and therefore by Chanel's conjecture you should have that. Yes? Yes, exponential of this. Okay, this is a good remark, thank you. And also I would like to say that these conditions have been weakened by Van, who just made that comment. Okay, so I put the condition that I had at that time. If these conditions are satisfied with an exponential here, then you know that the alpha i's are roots of unity times the exponential of the y i's. Then Chanel's conjecture gives you this. Conversely, suppose this conjecture is true and you want to prove Chanel's conjecture. Well, then you take alpha 1 to be exponential y1, alpha l to be exponential yl, and the existence of Pn is due to a general construction of Michel Wachmann. So this construction that we have for a long time already is enough to capture Chanel's conjecture. So if Chanel's conjecture is true, we should in principle be able to prove it this way. Doesn't mean that it will be proved this way, but it gives an angle of attack, you know, a possibility. You can make weaker conjectures, but I'm not sure for the one that you're asking. Yes. Okay. For example, you can have Chanel's conjecture for L equals 1. You see, Chanel's conjecture for fixed L is equivalent to that also. Okay. So now, how can you prove something like that? because you have small values, but they are not small enough to apply, for example, when L is 1, you would like to apply Gelfand's lemma, but this is not, it will never work, in fact, if you look at the inequalities that you have, they are too strong. And in Philippon's criterion, the inequalities are too strong. Even that, as they are stated, they are best possible results, when you try to apply them to a large number of quantities individually, you cannot conclude. So I thought I would explain to you, yes? Oh yes, for L equals, yes, you're right, for L equals 1, it works. Yes, so did I say L equals 1? Yes, okay. So for L equals 1, you want to prove that the numbers are not all algebraic, so you assume that they are algebraic and you apply Liouville inequality, it works. Yes, so Liouville inequality suffices to prove the conjecture in the case L is 1, and this gives a new proof that, well, this, another version of the proof that E is transcendental. Okay, so a strategy would be to combine those inequalities to produce other quantities that are much smaller, for which they are small enough to apply, for example, Gelfand's lemma. So this is the idea, and I would like to give you an example of this, which comes from a paper of Davenport and Schmidt, a very, very nice paper. So this strategy could be to combine inequalities like that to produce other quantities that are much smaller. So a possible strategy would be to combine small values to produce vanishing. And a remarkable example of this is in a paper of Davenport and Schmidt, 1969, where they look at algebraic approximation to real numbers by algebraic integers. And they use an auxiliary result, so I will just mention one special case of their theorem. Davenport and Schmidt, 1969. You fix, again, now here psi is a real number, before I use complex numbers, and you assume that for each x, here x is any real number, each real number x large enough, okay. There exists an integer point x with coordinate x0, xn in zn plus 1. Non-zero, such that the norm of x is at most x, and x is points very much in the direction of 1 psi psi n, okay, 1 such that x exterior product 1 psi. Psi 4 is bounded above by a constant times x to the minus 1 over 2. So this is the exterior product. So it's the set of 2 by 2 minors of the 2 by 5 matrix that you get by putting. You see, I wanted to give a special case, so it's 1 x0 up to x4 in z5, so n is 4. But the general result of Davenport and Schmidt is leaves with an arbitrary integer n. and C is an appropriate constant which is small enough, depending on D on psi. So I'm writing it the way they wrote it for an appropriate constant. Depending on E on psi, positive. So the statement should be, there exists a constant C depending on E on psi with the following property. Suppose that for each x there exists a point of norm at most, an integer point of norm at most x in Z5, whose exterior power with this geometric progression is bounded above like that. Then psi is quadratic over Q. Quadratic, at most quadratic over Q. Okay. So I hope you will not be angry against me if I give a sketch of proof of this, because you will see that, you see, so how many 2 by 2 minors you have, it's 2 choose 5, huh? And that's a lot of inequalities. So this is this norm is the maximum, I'm using the maximum norm, the maximum of 10 determinants, 10 2 by 2 determinants. So you have a lot of quantities that are small, but they are not small enough to conclude that psi is algebraic, you see. For example, if you look at the first minor, it's degree 1, but it's not small enough to apply Gelfand's lemma. You would have nu is 1 half, but beta is already 1. So it doesn't work. Okay. So the proof goes like that. You get. Okay. So what you do is for each x you have. Oh, there's a lot of x here. You have x here, you have x there, and psi is x in Greek, no? So it's a lot of x's. But for each capital X, you choose the X that gives the best, the smallest norm here. And in this way, you get a sequence of points. So starting from this, you get a sequence of points indexed by integers in Z5, such that if you denote by capital XI the norm of that point, this is increasing, strictly increasing, and here I denote by this the phi tuple which is here. This geometric progression, this is a geometric progression, I denote it by psi, and the capital psi. These they are decreasing, and in fact you can show that they are bounded above by this with the same constancy. Okay. So now this has captured exactly the data, because when you go from capital XI to capital XI plus 1, you use just XI. XI is good for all values of x from capital XI to capital XI plus 1. So this is a first step that where we haven't lost anything. Now, how do they combine these inequalities? Well, they look at the 3x3 matrix obtained by the circulant matrix obtained from this, the 3x3 circulant matrix obtained by, in fact, okay, they look at this matrix. Okay, so each point xi has 5 coordinates, xi0, xi1, xi2, xi3, xi4. this is a circulant matrix, and this inequality here means simply that this matrix is xi naught times 1 xi squared xi squared xi cubed xi squared psi cubed psi 4 plus a big O of c x I plus 1 to the minus 1 half. You do this. This big O doesn't, the constant here doesn't depend on c. Okay. So this point is points in a direction which is almost that of a geometric progression of ratio psi. And now, you see, this has determinant zero, this matrix. So it suggests to take the determinant of MI, and you find that the determinant of MI is bounded above by xi times this square. Okay. Which is, you see, smaller than c square. Well, and if c is small enough, you deduce that the determinant is zero. Okay. So this is, so starting with something where you cannot apply Gell-Franck criterion, you see, you get something in this way. Okay. And now, maybe I should continue, because the rest of the proof is very interesting. There are two cases. We've seen that the rank of this matrix is either 1 or 2. It cannot be 0 because the point x is not 0. So the rank is either 1 or 2. If the rank is 1, even if the rank is 1 infinitely often, then you can proceed in some way. I will not give the details in that case. It is simpler than the case I will look at. So there are two cases. The rank of MI of MI is 1 infinitely often. Well, they get rid of this. Eh? So maybe easily dispensed with is not correct, but this is the best approximation I can. Okay. So you can argue relatively easily in that case. In fact, what happens is that in that case, the points form a geometric progression, and you can show that the preceding point is also a geometric progression of the same ratio, and that's impossible. Okay. Okay. So let's look at the case where the rank is 2 all the time. Okay. So the since the rank can never be 3, the complementary case is that the rank of MI is 2 for all I sufficiently large. Okay. In that case, what they do is they look at an equation for the row space of MI. Okay. So you look at so you take an equation this is an equation for the row space of MI. Okay. And using the theory of height, they are able to show that in fact when I say an equation, so it means that the aij's are integer and they are coprime as a set. So you see, the three rows, they lie in a space of dimension 2, and this space has a normal vector, a unique normal vector, which is a primitive integer point up to multiplication by plus or minus 1. So you look at that equation, And they can well, okay. AI is okay. So AI is just this triple. This is primitive. Its norm is at most. So using the theory of height, you can show its norm is at most xi plus 1, the minus 1 half to the 1 half. So the norm is smaller than the fourth root of xi. And if you look, see the same approximation that I used on the first row gives you a good approximation for the scalar product of AI with the vector 1 psi squared. Essentially, you see, you can put here xi naught, xi 1, xi 2, and it will be 0. Okay. But then you use the approximation that I've written there, and you get that this is very small. This is bounded above by norm of AI, xi plus 1 to the minus 1 half over xi. The details are very interesting, but now you see you have a polynomial of small height taking small values at xi, and now you apply Gelfand's lemma to it. Okay, you see? So these were the old. Okay, so these are the, if you want, the raw data. These are the new data. And so now they are good enough to apply Gelfand's criterion, Gelfand's lemma. And you deduce that this polynomial must vanish for each I sufficiently large, and in particular, psi is quadratic, is at most quadratic over Q. Okay. Yes, you see, the polynomial must vanish, but these are non-zero polynomials. And you're done. So it's amusing to see that you start with a situation where you cannot apply Gelfand's criterion, or Liouville inequality. Or, yes. Well, these are polynomials, so you could try to apply Gelfand's lemma to them. That would be too strong. If this vector product would be zero, it would mean that psi is rational, and that's not true. That's not what you want to prove. The best is this. And this conclusion is best possible because if psi is quadratic, then there exist points satisfying this. So this result is best possible also. Okay, so I would like to finish in a few minutes by saying a very small step that I have in direction of this conjecture. Okay. So the small step that I I will use just one point and derivatives. So I will replace this by just one point. So the theorem is the following. You take a point psi eta. So this is the underlying algebraic group that we are looking at. You see, on the first component you have addition, and on the second component you have multiplication. And now you take two parameters. Beta tau nu real with satisfying the following conditions. Tau is at least 1, at most 2, but smaller than 2. Beta is greater than tau. Previously I had a much stronger inequality, but I was able to weaken it. And nu is at least 2 plus beta minus tau plus tau minus 1, 2 minus tau over beta plus 1 minus tau. So this is a positive quantity in view of the fact that tau is between 1 and 2. You assume that for each n, here I will index polynomials by their total degree. So I will change the notation. Here you see they were indexed by a parameter that controls the size of the coefficients. Here I will use something that controls the degree. Suppose that for each integer d sufficiently large, there exists a polynomial p sub d with integer coefficients in two variables x and y, not zero, with a degree of p sub d at most d, logarithm of the norm at most d to the beta, and maximum of the absolute value of the kth derivative of p at the point psi eta, k running from 0 to n tau, 3d tau, excuse me, 3d tau. Should be d everywhere, is bounded above by exponential minus d to the mu. Then psi n eta algebraic. And this polynomial, the derivatives vanish. And all derivatives vanish for k sufficiently large. Okay. In particular, eta cannot be the exponential of psi unless psi is zero. But if you assume psi is not zero, then this is impossible. So there is a similarity, except that you have just one point instead of this. So I would like to say just a few things about this. First of all, to get a result like that, tau should be at least 1. Otherwise, you can take a power of a linear form that would do it. There exists psi and eta. There's a construction of Xinxin that allows you to construct linear forms in 1 psi eta that are very small. And by raising that linear form to the dth power, you would get a polynomial satisfying any kind of inequality like that. So you need that the degree is that you differentiate much more than the degree. So tau at least 1 is needed to get anything like that to work. Nu greater than 2 plus beta minus tau would be best possible. See, if I reverse the inequality, I can construct this using the box principle. So that would be best possible. So we have an extra term here, which is relatively small. That product on the right is smaller than 1/4, so there is a saving with respect to using Patrice Philippon's criterion of algebraic independence. Okay, and that criterion would require. Okay, so Philippon's criterion would require nu at least 2 plus beta. So there is some saving because the extra term which is there is smaller than tau, in fact smaller than tau over 4. Now the proof of that is the main tool is we use the resultant, like in Patrice Philippon. So you know that there exists something called the resultant So I have 3 more minutes. Is that okay? 5 minutes, okay, thank you. So the idea is to use the resultant. The resultant is a... So there is a map which is called the resultant, which is a map taking an interpole of, here we work, so here I take x to be x naught, xn, and cx is just c adjoint x naught, xn. Here, the number of times, the number of factors is n plus 1. Okay, so in order to describe that it is n plus 1, I take an element of that set and I denote it by p naught pn, and this is mapped to some number which is called the resultant of p naught pn. And it has a remarkable property. The resultant is 0 if and only if this polynomial has a common 0 in projective n-space. Resultant is 0. So the zeros of the resultant are the polynomials the n plus 1 tuples of polynomials whose zero set is not empty. So I will erase this. When I mean that, I mean in projective space. Okay. So, if this polynomial has take a small value at a point, you infer that the resultant will be small, because a small perturbation of this polynomial will make the resultant zero, will make them have this point. You see, if they take a small value at a given point, then subtracting this value would give you polynomials vanishing at these points, and so the resultant would vanish. It means that the resultant is small when the polynomials have a small value at a point. What I use here is the fact that so what I prove is that the resultant not only so if you take polynomials from an ideal, so maybe it's simpler if I just write the statement, because it will be clearer. So the result that I prove is, so the main tool is the following. You take a homogeneous ideal of Cx. Suppose that for some integer b, at least 1, the set of zeros of the homogeneous elements of I of degree d is not empty. The set is not empty and finite. Then the number of points in that set is the degree of the ideal counting multiplicity. And what I show is that the resultant, then the resultant, that map that I have written here, vanishes up to multiplicity equal to the degree of I. The degree of I, as I said, is the number of points of that set counting multiplicity, the number of set, the number of points in the zero set of I, at each point of id to the n plus 1. See? So you take, if you take, if you look at the resultant at a point where p naught pm belong to id, the resultant and its derivative up to degree of I, they vanish. And the ideal that I take is the ideal of polynomials vanishing. So you look at the ideal of polynomials vanishing up with their derivative of degree, their derivative of order at most d to the tau at xi eta. So this is the main tool. So in this way, I get smaller value for the resultant. So I improve the application of Patrice Philippon's criterion, which uses just one value. Okay. So this is it.